Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 19th of May. One of our guests this hour is an astrophysicist who's at the University of Liège in Belgium, and he has said that he's always wanted to know whether humankind and all the biology with which we share our planet have company in the galaxy. Michael Gion says, I have always focused on extraterrestrial life. The idea to find life, one must find not just planets, but those that could be explored in depth from Earth. And indeed, we may have found that. An article in The Atlantic caught our attention, as we are very interested as well in possible life elsewhere. It's titled, Astronomers Have Found Planets in the Habitable Zone of a Nearby Star. The newly discovered worlds are now the most promising targets in the search for life among the stars, and the race to take a closer look at them has begun. The discovery was published in Nature magazine on May 2nd, and the lead author is that astrophysicist in Belgium, who is one of our guests this hour, Michael Gion, astrophysicist at the University of Liège, and also joining us in a little while, Thomas Levinson, professor of science writing at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we talk about this discovery. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Michael Gion, thank you very much for being with us all the way from Belgium. Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm fine. Thank you.
Great.
It's a pleasure.
Oh, it's a pleasure to hear all about this. We're excited to hear you talk. And we thank you, Tom, as well. Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah. Miguel, why don't we start with you? And Tom, you probably have a similar answer to this question, but I was interested to hear you quoted as saying that you always wanted to know if we're alone here. You want to know if there are other beings of some kind that might be out there. When did you start thinking about that? And it's obviously guided the course of your life.
I think I began to think about it when I was a teenager, even a kid. I couldn't stare at the stars without thinking, is there someone out there? And so from that time, I have always had this question in mind, probably fed by science fiction movies and books. And at some point, I decided to make this my job.
Well, I'm glad you did. What do you hope you'll find?
I hope to find some traces of biological activity on planets or on other stars. It would be really great to finally discover that life is not something extremely rare, but it's extremely common in the universe. This is something that I think is likely, but to demonstrate it through observations, it would be really great.
Yes, it really would be. And I want to find beings who are much smarter than we are, who can come and help us guide our future in a good path, you know? I think that would be good.
Yes, and, indeed. Maybe they could help us on some points.
Yeah, maybe they could. Tom, your article is fascinating in The Atlantic. Astronomers have found planets in the habitable zone of a nearby star. One of the things that's extraordinary about this is that it didn't cost very much to find these planets, and they're pretty close, aren't they?
Well, yes. Again, Miguel is the person to speak about, you know, what he discovered, and I merely talked to him about and reported on. But one thing I'd really like to put in front of your listeners is, writers of articles rarely write their own headlines, and I didn't write this one. And the great thing about this headline is it talks about habitable zones, whereas this discovery and many other discoveries that have happened in other aspects of this search for life beyond Earth sort of undermine the idea of a habitable zone at the same time as we're trying to explore exactly that. I mean, it used to be that we thought the only way you could get life was to have, you know, a nice rocky planet of just about the right size with good gravity and, you know, all the kinds of things that happen to look exactly like the Earth, you know, the one place where we know life really does exist in the universe right now. And every discovery that's happened over the last 30 or 40 years has, not every discovery, but many, many discoveries have pointed out ways in which we should rethink what it means to be a habitable zone. For example, we now think that if there's life in the solar system beyond Earth, it's very, you know, it's most promising places to look are places like moons around the gas giants that might have heat coming from, you know, the tidal pull of the big planet, Jupiter or Saturn, and that you get, you know, liquid oceans and places where life could hide maybe under an ice pack and this kind of thing. Nobody, when I was a kid first dreaming of life beyond Earth, nobody thought of such things, right?
Right.
And now we have this discovery of these rocky planets around a tiny star, nothing like our sun, really. I mean, very, very much smaller and dimmer and colder and all these things, with these tiny planets really, really close to the star, again, tidally locked. So they always point the same face towards the star. And there's an idea that there might be not everywhere on that planet, as you have more or less on Earth, but just in these little possible places where conditions could be just right to create the possibility for liquid water permanently present on the surface. That was, until this discovery, nobody had any idea that that could even conceivably, perhaps, maybe be a home for life.
Mm.
And that's what's so exciting to me is the habitable zone is getting much stranger and in certain ways much larger than we ever dreamed it could be.
Right. So, Mikhail, of all the billions of stars out there, why did you look at these, what are called ultra-cool dwarfs?
Yeah, I did it because of a pragmatic reason. I looked at what we could do now with our current technology in terms of detailed study of planets that could host life. So a planet of the size of the Earth that could have an atmosphere and liquid water and so on. And I found out that only for planets orbiting around stars the size of Jupiter, so extremely small stars and very faint stars, only for these stars we could hope to use our technology, our telescopes like Hubble and then afterwards the James Webb Space Telescope, which is in preparation by NASA, we could detect life on these planets. For all the other planets that were found, for instance, by the Kepler mission that found thousands of planets, if they have some potential for life, we just can't check, because we can't observe the atmosphere, probe the atmospheric composition, and say something relevant about the surface condition and so on. So this is really the only niche with current technology where we can really search for life now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's naturally that I decided to go and to look at these stars.
And you did it when you look at how much a lot of these journeys and studies of planets, how much money it has taken. You did this baby on a shoestring, didn't you? $400,000 for a robotic, it's a robot you used to take a look at all of this?
Yes, indeed. We used a small robotic telescope, which has an aperture, a diameter of its primary mirror of 60 centimeters. So this is smaller than the table near me here at home. So it's really, really small. It's something that is only 75 kilograms. So it's really
wow.
Lightweight telescope. Some amateur astronomers could have this kind of telescope in the garden if they have enough money. It's not unthinkable. So, but what you really need to study these stars is a telescope that is fully dedicated to this project, because it has to observe these stars one by one, because these stars, there are about 1,000 of them for which we could study a planet like the Earth. They are spread all over the sky. So we have to do them one by one and search for the crossing of planets, of possible planets in front of the star, what are called transits. And you really have to do it one by one, so you really need a dedicated telescope. It doesn't have to be very big, but it has to be dedicated. It has to be, optimized to do this, especially to observe the infrared light, not in the visible, but in the infrared, because these very small stars emit most of the light in the infrared. And you have to be very, very patient, and it's a high-risk, high-payoff enterprise, because you're not sure at all that you will detect something, and you have to wait years to get something. But at the end, it paid.
Yeah, I guess it did. How many transits did you see?
Well, we saw with our small telescope, which is called TRAPPIST, we saw 11 transits, and we could attribute to three planets these 11 transits. So we had three orbital periods that were coming from this data. Two were clearly determined from our data. And for the third one, we had, and we still have several possibilities. So the outer planet, we are not sure of its exact orbital period and so of its exact position, distance to the star. So it could be in what is called the habitable zone, so the zone where you could have liquid water on the wall surface of the planet, or it could be farther. It could be a big ball of ice or a frozen planet, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the situation now. And to really be sure of our detection, we used bigger telescopes to confirm the periods, to confirm the transits. And in this enterprise of confirmation, a girl from Wisconsin played a key role.
Really?
She is Suzanne Lederer, NASA scientist from Wisconsin, and she managed the observation with a telescope at Hawaii, an infrared telescope at Hawaii, that played really a key role in the confirmation and in the discovery itself.
Well, we're happy to do what we can.
Wisconsin played an important role in this discovery, sure.
Yeah, that's very exciting. And Thomas, when you look at how much other adventures and telescope projects have cost, am I right in saying that $400,000 is just, they're getting by with something that you would think would have cost billions of dollars?
Well, it's a rounding error for one of the extremely large telescopes that people are putting into Chile and elsewhere right now, these 30-meter class telescopes that people are trying to build that run, don't leave much change out of $1 billion. But I mean, the other thing is that yes, I mean, what's wonderful about this is it uses all the elegance of design and constructing a very, thinking of a specific mission you can do with these telescopes that can really, be dedicated. The tradition of doing sort of specialized and smaller telescopes to look for things is not, it's not 100% new with the TRAPPIST telescope. I mean, you have the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which has been searching the entire sky with small robotic, small telescopes. And efforts to find Earth-crossing asteroids. There are all kinds of things that don't, in fact, require a 10-meter telescope or bigger. But can be really, really useful to do great work. I mean, I think the best way to think about what's wonderful about this is it's a very cheap way to do some very, very exciting science in an area that's, in some senses, not as glamorous. I mean, it's, the really deep space stuff, the looking for the most distant quasar or finding the earliest galaxies or these kinds of things are incredibly important and they get a lot of publicity. But what TRAPPIST and the team that Michel built around him and the work they're going to do when they get their next generation version of this telescope, all of this stuff is a reminder that, there's much, much more we don't know even about our own intimate astronomical neighborhood than that which we do know. I mean, again, not that many years ago, astronomy was seen by physicists as kind of, a stamp collecting sport. We basically know it's out there. We're trying to figure out the fundamental laws. And, let the people play with their telescopes and find some new stuff, but it's nothing fundamentally new is going to show up. And over and over and over again, with big telescopes and with small telescopes, when people being very clever with limited resources and sometimes just building a big telescope and looking at what's out there and suddenly seeing stuff you never imagined show up, all these things have over the last few decades turned this into one of the most exciting times to be in love with the night sky, because there's so much out there we don't know.
Oh, well, let me have both of you respond to this, because it shows how big a discovery this is. You write, Thomas, in your piece in The Atlantic, before TRAPPIST launch, the preponderance of astronomical opinion held that such planets couldn't exist. The prediction was that the protoplanetary disk around such small stars would be too thin to make planets. So all of a sudden you found out they do exist. This is a big discovery, Michel, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. In fact, the models, theoretical prediction did not say that there would be no planet, but they would be very small, like Mars or even smaller. And because they would be so small, they wouldn't have a gravity large enough to keep the water, to keep an atmosphere, so they would have no astrobiological potential. We could not hope for life on such small planets. Look at our Mars. It's in the habitable zone of the Sun, and still it has lost its atmosphere because it doesn't have enough mass to keep it. And it's a dead world, so we can hope for maybe some bacteria surviving somewhere beneath the ground. But from our perspective, it's really a dead world. So there were not such a large interest because of this theoretical prediction, I think, about searching for these planets. And my guess was that, in fact, there was enough material in the disk to form bigger planet like the Earth,
mm-hmm.
very rich in water and with a large astrobiological potential. So this was a bet, and it worked out. So it's great, but it means that you can't always believe in the theoretical predictions. They are often completely wrong. And this is what is great with science, is that you learn not from the theoretical prediction, but from the observations.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really a good illustration of this.
Yeah, well, this whole finding is what's great with science as well. What happens now with these larger telescopes, the James Webb telescope? Is that 2018 launch? Are you going to be able to use those large, more powerful telescopes to find out more about your discovery?
Oh, yes. It's clearly a telescope which is powerful enough to give us a clear answer about the existence of an atmosphere and about its composition.
Mm.
And there is a large excitement in the James Webb community about the planets. Many scientists are thinking about using the James Webb to observe the planets of TRAPPIST right now. And I know that there was a meeting of people involved in James Webb on the instruments 2 weeks ago or 1 week ago, and TRAPPIST-1 was really a hot topic among this community. So, yes, I'm pretty sure that thanks to James Webb, we will learn a lot about the planet.
Mm-hmm. Can you add to that, Tom?
Sure. I think the one piece of the puzzle that I think is just sweet from the point of view of people who love this stuff is it's actually possible, sitting here on Earth, to tell what distant objects are made of. And we can do that because of a technique first discovered in the 19th century called spectroscopy. You know, when you heat up material, it emits light, and it emits light with particular kinds of patterns of light and dark lines within the spectrum of light. That's why it's called spectroscopy, from, you know, in our visible range from red to blue, and then you know, beyond infrared that's cooler, a longer wavelength, and ultraviolet, and so forth and so on, all the way through the electromagnetic spectrum. And using the James Webb telescope, you know, in order to do spectroscopy of a distant object, you need two things. You need a big enough telescope to collect lots of light, because it takes a fair amount of light to process a spectrum and see all the detail that can be found there. And then you need a really good spectroscope. And the James Webb is both. It's big. It is sensitive in the right range of light for these planets. It's infrared. It's in, you know, cooler, longer wavelengths than our eyes see. And, you know, you can tell by the specific patterns whether there's oxygen there or different molecules, you know, carbon dioxide or what have you. And that allows you to tell not just what's there, but if the chemistry is right, if the right elements are there and you understand the chemistry that goes into putting stuff like that into an atmosphere, you can infer something about the processes that put them there. And that's actually how, in the end, we'll be able to tell whether or not it's likely that there's life on any of these extrasolar worlds, is if we can get a big enough telescope pointed at a planet oriented in the right direction for our observations that shows the right chemistry that suggests life had to make it. I mean, if you looked at the Earth from Mars without seeing any city lights or anything like that, but you just looked at our atmosphere and you were a Martian physicist who understood, you know, atomic and molecular physics and chemistry, you could tell without really any doubt at all that there had to be biology on the Earth because our atmosphere does not look anything like the atmosphere of a planet without life. It's got lots of oxygen. It's got other things going on in it that you don't get without life. And we hope to do the same things for, you know, TRAPPIST planets and any other planets that Michelle or any of the other exoplanet hunters may find over the next years and decades.
Yeah, and if indeed we find there's life, then that thing that Mikkel said earlier, the possibility that it's everywhere is just dumbfounding, isn't it? Before we take phone calls, I just want to get the names here right. What is the name? How do we refer to this? Does that star that has the planets going around it have a name, Mikkel?
Yes, before the discovery, it had a name which was a catalog name which was really, really ugly. It was Tumas, JP, and then a lot of numbers. But when an exoplanet survey detects a planet, it is a kind of habit to give the name of the survey and then a number for. And here it's TRAPPIST that discovered the planet, so the star is renamed TRAPPIST 1,
okay,
because it's the first planetary system discovered by TRAPPIST. And the planets themselves, the rule is to give them the name of the star plus a letter starting with B for the inner planet and going to C, D, and so on.
Okay.
So we have TRAPPIST 1B, TRAPPIST 1C, and TRAPPIST 1D.
Okay. Well, let's welcome phone calls about TRAPPIST and TRAPPIST 1B, C, and D. An incredible discovery. You can read about this. It's on our Facebook page if you want to read the article in The Atlantic. Astronomers have found planets in the habitable zone of a nearby star. The newly discovered worlds are now the most promising targets in the search for life among the stars, and the race to take a closer look at them has begun. It's a remarkable discovery. Of all the billions of stars in the sky, they zeroed in, our guest, an astrophysicist at the University of Liège in Belgium, on this particular area, and lo and behold, look at what they've found, and with a more powerful telescope to find out if indeed there is life there, it could very well mean that life could be in all kinds of places, because there are a lot of stars. Well, we welcome your phone calls, and we have two guests with us, Mikkel Gion, who's an astrophysicist at the University of Liège. It is his and other astrophysicists' discovery, and he wrote the article in Nature, published on May 2nd. He was the lead author. Thomas Levinson is a professor of science writing at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And the other thing, you know, forgive me, but I don't think we've talked about how close these are, which makes a difference, too. It's not like it's lots and lots and lots and lots of light years away, so we'll talk about how close they are. And welcome any phone calls you have. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, so get a hold of us any of those ways. That's at K Dunn Show. So we're going to go to phone calls for our guests. Our number here is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we start our calls, gentlemen, with Sullivan in Green Bay. Hi, Sullivan.
Yes. I just had one question, specifically for Mikkel. Since the planets are so close to the Earth and our solar system here, does that mean that life has to be a bit more localized here in the Milky Way galaxy, or can it be a bit more distant?
We are searching in the solar neighborhood just because with our current technology we could not explore stars that are much farther in the galaxy or in other galaxies. Not a single planet has been detected outside our galaxy, in other galaxies, not because they do not exist, but because we just can't. So we are limited to search first for in the solar neighborhoods, in really for the stars that are very, very close. And I hope that one day, after having developing our technology, we'll be able to probe the entire galaxy. But we have to do this step by step. So we start by the nearest stars.
And how far away is TRAPPIST 1?
It's 40 light years, which is very far for our probes that for our current technology, yeah, we are far from being able to send something there. But 40 light years is really nothing compared to the scale of the galaxy, which is 100,000 light years in diameter. So it's really, really close at galactic scale.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering about, both of you can respond to this, what kind of technology it takes, what's inside that little robot that allows you to get the pictures from something that's 40 light years away? That's far away.
Oh, we don't get a picture of the planet. What TRAPPIST does is just measuring the brightness of the stars, monitoring them, and it detects a small drop of brightness when the planet passes in front of the star. So it's just required to be precise on the measurements of the brightness of the star, but it doesn't require an extremely huge telescope that will be able to make an image of the planet. Anyway, we wouldn't be able with current technology to do this, to make an image of the planet. But for this specific thing, which is called photometry, measuring the brightness of the star, you don't need a very sophisticated technology. You just need a good detector and a good telescope, and especially you need a very good location on Earth, because the weather makes a difference.
And we
if the telescope was in Belgium, it would be catastrophic.
And where is the telescope? Where the robot?
In Chile, in the Atacama Desert, which is one of the driest places on Earth, and which is perfect for astronomy. The sky is very clear. You don't have water and humidity in the atmosphere to bother your measurements, so it's very good for measuring the brightness of the stars.
Yeah. Sullivan, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Earl in Medford. Hi, Earl.
Hi, thanks. Great topic. But I was wondering, even some scientists that from time to time say, we should not send a signal to some of these places because then they would know we're here and that might cause us some problems, or they might come and invade us. Is that really true?
Thomas, is that true?
First of all, you know, this brings up the inevitable reference to possibly the funniest movie ever made, Galaxy Quest, where you recall that the alien species had been picking up our TV signals, in this sort of radiating outwards from since the birth of TV. So, you know, shows in the 60s have had, you know, 50 light years now. There's a radius of sphere, 50 light years in radius, in which people can watch reruns of Gilligan's Island. And, you know, in that particular movie, the aliens were shocked to learn that it wasn't a documentary. So the short answer is there are many things, I think, that humanity has to worry about before we have to worry about, you know, seemingly benevolent aliens showing up with a manual about how to deal with Earthlings that turns out to be a cookbook. It's difficult enough to send signals across long distances that can be understood. It's much, much, much more difficult to actually travel across these enormous distances. We've got global warming and the supervolcano beneath Yellowstone and conflict and the existence of nuclear weapons and so on and on and on. Mm-hmm. We got a lot of problems before I'm going to start worrying about aliens picking up on either the latest episode of Game of Thrones or a more directed signal.
And chances are, if they can pick up on our signals and understand us, they're smarter than we are, right? They're a lot older than we are.
Well, I mean, that's actually also very, I mean, who knows? Who knows,
right?
Yeah, but the interesting thing there is people have sort of tried to think about what the scale of the universe implies for intelligent life elsewhere. And you get into all kinds of complications really quickly because, you know, on Earth, species go extinct. You know, species have a lifespan, you know, some millions of years, from the first ducks to the last ducks and this kind of thing, or the first, you know, mallard ducks or whatever it is. Modern human beings are a few hundred thousand, you know, 100,000, few hundred thousand years old for Homo sapiens. So at some point, you know, our species will go extinct if we're like every other species that's ever been on Earth. And, you know, you extrapolate that to cosmological scales, maybe intelligence is the universe is almost 14 billion years old. And if species only have 5 million, you know, intelligent species only have 5 million year lifespans, you know, you could have a lot of planets out there that have had life or will have life, mm-hmm. but don't have life while we're around. So there are lots of ways. I mean, it's a really fun question to think about,
right.
But there really aren't any good answers.
Yeah. You have said in Thomas's piece, Miguel, that we can even search for communication from intelligent life if we're optimistic enough. You say, I'm not very optimistic, but it's basically free to try. How do we try?
Communication is the SETI enterprise. So we just look at the stars with radio telescope, and we hope that someone there is beaming a strong signal to Earth and trying to send us a message. If it's just if we are searching for leaks, it's really hopeless because, for instance, on Earth we had a few decades of strong leaks of radio due to our broadcasts in radio and television and so on, but it's already over. So we shouldn't hope to detect leaks from intelligent species. We really have to hope that they are trying to contact us very actively. So some people could think about doing it, but here, looking at these planets that are orbiting a star which is very different from our sun, I have no idea if intelligence could happen there. We don't know how intelligence evolved on Earth. It seems to be evolution seems to be a very stochastic, chaotic process, and it's just trying and plenty of solution, and the one that survive go on. So it's very difficult to say something about these worlds. And my guess, if I had to guess, is that if there's life, it will be more something like a microbial life, which is much, much more, resistant to harsh conditions than an intelligent species like ours that requires plenty of, let's say, of specific conditions to evolve, and some luck also to evolve and that's it.
Yeah. Thank you, Earl, for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. You write in the article, Thomas, about how we've explored most spots on Earth, except perhaps the ocean, which may be explored further, and I hope that it will be because we might find some wonderful things there. So it's natural that we should go to the stars, our next kind of frontier. Are there other places on Earth, though, that could lead us to a better understanding of if indeed there might be habitable conditions on other planets? Are there, you know, rocks that we need to drill into that we haven't before, et cetera?
This actually picks up from what Miguel was just saying, which is one of the things that, you know, it's true, the surface of the Earth, the land surface of the Earth has been pretty well explored. It's also true that, you know, we go into dense jungles in Southeast Asia or in the Amazon, and new species are found all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, we really have a pretty good, I mean, we have satellites measuring, you know, we've mapped our world very well, but there are still surprises here. One of the biggest surprises of recent years, and one of the ones that has also changed our understanding of what it means to have a habitable zone, has been the discovery of what are called extremophiles. These are microbes, bacteria and archaea, the single-celled organisms, that exist in conditions that, again, when I was studying biology in high school, nobody would have thought these would have been appropriate for life. These are places that are extremely cold or very, very hot, like the geysers at Yellowstone, or under, you know, enormous pressure deep inside, you know, fissures deep in rock and so on and so forth.
Right.
The deep ocean vents, which turn out to support not just microbes, but whole thriving ecosystems that, again, no sunlight at all. The only ecosystems on Earth that we know of so far that do not depend on energy from the sun, directly from the sun. And it turns out that the Earth's own habitable zone is much larger than we imagined it to be in our own lifetimes. I mean, this isn't, you know, like, oh, we know more than they knew in the 17th century. We know things that really sort of shock our understanding of what it means to be hospitable to life that have been discovered in the last, you know, in the last 30 years to last year or this year. I mean, these discoveries, understanding how extremophiles work, understanding the diversity and power of these organisms. I mean, it's really, it's shocking how wonderful some of these lines of inquiry have turned out to be. Mm-hmm. And these are the things I think that make the search for extraterrestrial life so fascinating and so challenging because, you know, it used to be we thought we had to find an Earth-like solar system, a sun-like solar system out there and explore that. Now we can look everywhere,
right.
And if you do something really clever like Miguel just and his team just did, you can find something that, again, expands our understanding of what's possible in the universe.
Right. Oh, yeah, that's great. Miguel, are there discoveries that you would like to have us make here on Earth that would aid you in your examination of these exoplanets?
Well, there are the technological developments that are always welcome to get better precision and to go to smaller and smaller planets, farther and farther planets, and better precision in the measurements that, that really help us to constrain the composition of the planet, the atmospheric condition, and so on. But also, like Thomas said, the study of the different metabolism of the different kind of life on Earth are really required to search for life elsewhere. Because if we look at our Earth, there are plenty of different metabolism that we find in different places, especially in these extremophiles. And all these different forms of life emit different forms of molecules, of gases, and this is the traces of life that we would measure in the atmosphere of this exoplanet because we can't send a probe and just look at what is there. So we really have to understand the measurements that we would do on these exoplanets that are potentially habitable. So we really need to have a deep understanding of these possible biosignatures by studying what is made on Earth. Because we won't be able, I think, to detect something, a form of life that is completely alien. We would find something with a given amount of certainty that is like something we know on Earth. So we really have to go deep in the biological studies to know what we can expect around the stars.
Mm. We're going to welcome our phone calls. We're talking this hour, in case you're just tuning us in, about a remarkable discovery that was written about in Nature magazine on May 2nd. Astronomers, as one of our guests has written in The Atlantic, has been spotting planets around distant stars for years now. But now there is a discovery of new exoplanets, and what we found here is different, or what one of our guests this hour has found, not only because they're close, like Earth, they could potentially permit liquid water to persist on their surfaces, a precondition for the emergence of life. The discovery of these, TRAPPIST-1 and the planets orbiting B, C, and D, our newly discovered worlds, the most promising targets in the search for life among the stars. They are not, well, they're far away, but they're 40 million light years away instead of even farther than that. And we've been able to look at the planets, the transit of the planets that are going around TRAPPIST-1. Because of the work of one of our guests, Michael Gion, astrophysicist at the University of Liège in Belgium. And they've been doing all of this with a remote robot who's been located in Chile, where the conditions are right to be able to get really clear idea of what's going on. So it's pretty remarkable because we weren't looking at these little guys, you know, where they're kind of ignored. We're looking at the brighter, bigger, more glamorous exoplanets, and this is a dwarf. It's small, it's kind of dim in the sky, and lo and behold, it was the right one to look at because it's extraordinary what they have been able to found. This class of stars turns out to be quite promising. Well, we welcome your phone calls, so here's how you reach us. The number is 800 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, or on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Our guests are Michael Gion, astrophysicist at the University of Liège in Belgium, and Thomas Levinson, a professor of science writing at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, author of The Hunt for Vulcan. All right, let's go back to your phone calls, 800-486-8655. Nicole in Franklin is our next caller, gentlemen. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hi, guests. So I was thinking, you said earlier that intelligent life has a limited window of time, like 5 million years or whatever. And you said also that you're looking at planets that are 40 million light years away, meaning we're looking at them 40 million years in the past. So 40 million years ago, there wasn't intelligent life on Earth. So what is the likelihood of you guys catching intelligent life? You know, if it's been, there's such a limited time that intelligent life is on the planet. And, you know, did you understand my question?
Yeah, we got it.
I do. Couple things. First of all, those stars are 40 light years away, not 40 million. They're lots and lots of miles away, but they're only 40 light years away. So there was, my parents were around 40 years ago, and they were intelligent. So, but the other thing to remember about all this is, you know, just as up until really the 80s. We thought there would be planets around other stars, but we really only had one data point on what a solar system could look like. So we started looking for things like around our sun. I think Michael and I would both agree, and basically every astronomer I've ever spoken to agrees that given what we now know about the likely number of planets around other stars, the odds that the Earth is the only place where there is life in our galaxy, much less the universe, are vanishingly small. The law of large numbers. The fact of these large numbers suggests, and also just sort of the realization that at every turn, human beings have found themselves less distinct, less special, less unique than we imagined in all kinds of ways. You know, so we only know one planet with a history of life and evolution working as it's done, you know, through one cycle and so forth and so on. So on Earth, given our circumstances, species emerge, develop, and go extinct at some average rate of some small number of millions of years. But that's the only one we know about. It doesn't mean that, you know, TRAPPIST-1b has to behave the same way,
right,
or, you know, planets around, you know, in the Orion, mm-hmm. We only know this one thing, and the only thing we can be really sure of everything we think is absolutely required for some system to work, because that's the way it works here on Earth, isn't required. Is likely not required at all elsewhere where they do it differently, right? So you can't, there are lots of reasons why it's unlikely we will see other intelligent species, but those are the reasons we can think of. And there are other reasons why it would be extremely likely that there should be other intelligent species, maybe in range to communicate with us, maybe not. Mm-hmm. We just, we can speculate, we can think, we can reason, we can construct scenarios. But the one thing we can't do is know for sure.
Mm. Thanks, Nicole, so much for your call. Greg in Eau Claire is next. Hi, Greg.
Hi, good afternoon. Wondering about the technology. If I understand it right, you're trying to find that sweet spot where the atmosphere of this planet will just come out of the sun and get just enough sunlight to do the analysis. And I'm wondering, what are the specific things you would be looking for that you would say, yep, there's life there? And two, is there a way that you could actually use that same technique, or maybe already have, looking at some of the planets in our own solar system that have water but also have geysers, where you could look at what makes up the geysers to see if those very same things were there?
Mm. Michael?
Yes, so the technique to study the atmosphere is based on the transit themselves. We observe during the transit a part of the light of the star that passes in the atmosphere and is filtered by the atmosphere. And this filtration really depends on the chemical composition and parameters of the atmospheres. So this small fraction of the light coming from the star that is filtered by the atmospheres is very rich in information about the atmospheric composition. But as it is only a small fraction, it is why we really need to focus on small stars, because this fraction for the same size of the planet, for the same atmosphere, is relatively bigger for these small stars. So we have larger signals. So we can apply these techniques on big planets, on giant planets. We have also applied this on a bit smaller planets, which are called super-Earth. We are starting to do this, not on habitable ones, but still on super-Earths. And but to go to Earth-sized planets, we really have to go to these ultra-cool stars, which are super, super small. Now, these techniques have already been applied, in fact, in the solar system themselves. So there are plenty of missions that have used this to study the atmosphere of solar system objects, including from the ground. When we observe, for instance, Pluto that is passing in front of a star, we can detect the atmosphere of Pluto just because the atmosphere is going to pass in front of the star. This is called an occultation. And you will have an effect that is of filtration of the light from the background star by the atmosphere that tells us about the atmosphere of Pluto. So in fact, the atmosphere of Pluto was detected through this technique. So we're just using the techniques that were, invented for the solar system. We use them now on extrasolar planets.
Mm. Thanks, Greg, for your call. You know, La Crosse, Dave, hi.
Okay, thanks. I was just wondering, I tuned in a little late. Can you tell me what type of star this is and how big, and if it has star spots or sunspots that would confuse the observing for transits?
Miguel?
Excuse me, I didn't understand the question.
What kind of star it is? If you can just, he tuned in late. Can you talk about what kind of star it is and if it would have sunspots or any kind of light that would interfere with the transits?
Okay, so these ultra-cool dwarfs have a mass of about 8%, 10% the mass of the Sun. If they are stars, they can be even less massive, and they become what are called brown dwarfs. So these brown dwarfs are failed stars. They have not enough pressure and temperature high enough in the core to initiate the nuclear fusions. So they are things that are formed like stars, but that just cool down and become very, very cool after a few billions of years. And these tiny stars are much more frequent than solar-type stars in the galaxy. They represent, ultra-cool dwarfs represent about 20-30% of the galaxy. So they are solar-type star is about 10%, 5%. So they are really, really frequent in the galaxy. And they have a very, very long lifetime. The Sun has a lifetime of about 10 billion years. It is at half of its life now. Hmm. And in 5 billion years, it will become bigger and bigger, and it will lose its envelope, and it will die. It will end up as it's called a white dwarf. These stars, because they are very, economic, they use the hydrogen very, very slowly. They can last for 100, several hundreds of billion years.
Wow.
So it's funny to think that even if life is not there now, it has the time to appear. If the condition just become right for life to appear on this planet in 10 billion years, it's very okay. So these are objects that will be there for nearly forever compared to the Sun.
Wow. Well, we better find out what they are before we're gone, right?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
Yes. About the transit, it's true that they have some magnetic activity. They are known to have big spots and so on that could alter the measurement of the atmosphere. But we think we can master these problems, and we can really probe the atmospheric composition without any problem because we really understand what's going on.
Thank you both so much. What a fascinating hour, and we'll direct people, Thomas, to your article, too. Thank you both.
Thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Thank you. Our pleasure, too. Michael Gion, astrophysicist at the University of Liège in Belgium. Thomas Levinson, professor of science writing at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Go to the Kathleen Dunn Show. The Atlantic article is there, and it's a fascinating story. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour. Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee.